Thank you, Sue Ann. Hi, everybody. My name's Don Major, and I'm an alcoholic. And I'm just real grateful to be here today. Mert called, gosh, I guess it was almost a year and a half ago, and asked if we could be here, and I immediately said yeah, because I wanted to come. And I don't think I knew at that time that we were going to have such a rerun of that Jekyll Allen conference. And I told Creighton that the growth as I go along in this program is so remarkable, because last night I was able to refrain from correcting him that was the 1991 Jekyll Allen conference. I waited until immediately after the talk and caught him as he was coming off the podium to correct him. And I thought that was much more tasteful than my natural tendency to do that. But it's great to see a lot of old friends and meet a lot of new friends. And thank you so much. And we, on account of our schedule, weren't able to get here until late yesterday afternoon, so I already missed some really good talks. We got some great reviews on them, including Ray there. But Creighton last night and Francine this morning just were both beautiful. In fact, I don't see Francine right now. Oh, there she is. But I wanted to tell Francine this morning that she told a great deal of my story. And I got to thinking about the similarities. Now, we start out a little different, because I start out white, male, coming up in a rural area. Now, there's some little difference in how we got there. Francine said this morning that she had done this beautiful and difficult thing of going to school full-time and working full-time and still practicing this program of Alcoholics Anonymous and going to her meetings. You ought to try working full-time, going to school full-time, and drinking alcoholically full-time if you think that's tough. So we did it kind of backwards, but we both wound up sort of drunks that aren't drinking today, lawyers standing up giving an AA talk. And another thing, Francine talked about that cat, her pet dying, and I'm not going to say that I identify that with that a whole lot, but I did tell Sharon when we got back to the room that in 5 more days on August 11, Puff, my Siamese Tom, will have been dead for 7 years. So something about remembering the day he's gone. So we've got a lot in common, and I'm just so grateful to be here, and if I can, you know, thank all of you. I couldn't thank you enough, so thank the committee. Thank all of you collectively and individually. And now I need to try to get myself out of the way and share with you folks in a general way what I used to be like and what happened and what I'm like now. And my body grew up on a farm in southwestern Kentucky. The rest of me is still kind of tagging along, you know, the old deal of growing up and growing old at the same time. And before I got sober, I had in many ways a far more dramatic story than I have now, because I had a story that elevated itself to a saga about how by my sterling intellect and my iron will, I had pulled myself up by the bootstraps from the depths of poverty to the staggering heights that I had reached. And in the course of telling you that, I would almost invariably bring tears to your eyes and mine both, because I was so sincere about it. And I hadn't been sober a month before I realized that was all a bunch of crap. In the first place, we weren't poor. We were middle-class farming people that had everything we needed and really some of the things that we wanted. And those heights were a great deal more staggering than they were high. I was one of those legends in my own mind. In fact, there's a portion of my story that for 12 years now, and by the way, by the grace of God, I've been sober and clean in Alcoholics Anonymous one day at a time since April 9th, 1981. And there's a period in my story when I practiced law in Louisville, Kentucky, before I got sober. And you know, when I first got sober, I had been wildly successful during that 10 years. And over the course of 12 years, I have become moderately successful during that 10 years. And I guess if I stay sober 25, I may have been a failure during that 10 years. But there's something about the perception of the way we look at things. When I look back on my childhood now, the only thing I think is remarkable about it is the way I felt. And Creighton talked about it. Francine talked about it. I expect everybody that gets to this podium will talk about it. And we all use somewhat different words. But for me, I've always been an egomaniac with an inferiority complex. I've always been perfectly capable of feeling too good for something and too bad for the same thing at the same time. Too smart for something and too dumb for the same thing at the same time. As far back as I can remember, I never once as a child remember feeling like I was in the right place at the right time with the right stuff. And I was never, ever once able to stand still and say to myself down inside, "Hey, Don, how are you doing?" Because when I tried to do that, I invariably got this answer, "Don't be asking that. Because, buddy, you can't stand the answer. You keep moving. You do your cute and smart act. And if that won't float, then you create a negative disturbance. But you do whatever you've got to do to keep anybody else from drawing a bead on you. Because if anybody else draws a bead on you and sees what's inside you, then you're going to have to stop and look at it, and you won't be able to stand that. The earth will swallow you up." My first sponsor told me probably 80% of the things that I'll share with you today came to me through Cherry Carpenter, who died almost 4 years ago. He was my first sponsor, Cherry Carpenter from Nashville, Tennessee. And one of the very first things he told me is that I've got an incurable, progressive, and fatal disease called alcoholism. And he told me that it is essentially a disease of big deals. It's a disease that made me very sick physically, mentally, emotionally, and spiritually, but it didn't start out as any of those things. He explained to me that what's wrong with me, the basic thing that has always been wrong with me and the basic thing that's wrong with me today, is that I've got a disorder of my ego that makes me so self-centered that I am unable to be comfortable inside myself without something from outside myself to fill up that hole in my belly that makes me so uncomfortable inside. And as a result of that ego sickness, as far back as I can remember, I never gave any consideration at all to the idea that there might be a power greater than myself that had anything to do with running my life on a daily basis. Now, I always had some sort of cockamamie intellectual theory about creation and pretty generally thought that my intellectual ancestors created God to keep your intellectual ancestors in line. And I could understand how you needed this simple little myth of a higher power to order your simple lives. But, of course, for somebody who lived on my intellectual plane, that wasn't necessary. Also connected with that ego sickness, I got sober when I was 37, by the way. I'm 49 now. And connected with that sickness, I don't think for that first 37 years of my life I had any teachability or humility whatsoever. Now, if you had asked me during that time if I had any teachability, I would let you know real quickly that I could learn anything as quickly as anybody you ever saw think it. And if you had mentioned humility, my eyes would probably have glazed over. Because to the limited extent that I ever thought about things like humility and gratitude, I sort of vaguely assumed that they were character defects. You see, I was exposed to you folks in this program for 2.5 years before I began to get any inkling of how self-will could be a character defect, because I had lived my entire life absolutely convinced that a strong self-will was the greatest asset that I could ever have. The reason I believe now I didn't have any teachability or humility is because of the way I define that today, and to me they're one and the same. You folks have taught me that. You see, for that first 37 years, I don't remember ever once voluntarily following a suggestion that anybody made about how to run my life unless my little old brain understood it, agreed with it, and thought it would work. I had given my little brain the ultimate veto power in the universe. And the really scary part of that is that I was convinced that that was the only proper way for an intelligent person to run their life. I realize now that with the disease I've got, I had the chief inmate in charge of the asylum. And furthermore, that with the disease I've got, as long as I held on to that veto power in my brain, I was under death sentence. And I believe today that just to the extent that I give that veto power back to that brain, I move back toward that death sentence. I believe that with all my heart. Tell you one more thing about what I was like, and then I'll move on. I always wanted to be an alcoholic. Now, I didn't know I always wanted to be an alcoholic until I'd been sober about a year. But see, around this farm where I grew up, there were a lot of really hard-working, decent men. And I could name a dozen of them. And being as self-centered as I've always been, I looked at them just exactly like I looked at everything else in my life, with only one thought and one question: what's this got to do with me? And I would look around at these guys, and the guys that I'm talking about, you all know people like this, whether you came from a farm or not. These fellows had real dull lives. And these fellows were real responsible, good, decent human beings. These guys would usually drive an old pickup truck that was 10 or 15 years old and beat up, but it'd be paid for. They wouldn't owe a nickel on that old pickup truck. And they'd usually be married to some old gal, and 40-odd years ago down in my part of the country, lots of times those women would wear those dresses that looked a whole lot like flour sacks, you know. And I'd look around, and those women were really drab-looking to me. And these guys would have 3, 4, 5, 6 little old snotty-nosed kids running around. And they'd get up every morning and eat breakfast with that drab-looking woman and those little old kids, and they'd go get in that old paid-for pickup truck and go right exactly where they were supposed to go and dig in the dirt all day the way they were supposed to and come home to the same woman they left that morning. And they'd get up the next morning and do the same thing right over again. And then maybe on Sunday they'd load that whole crew in that old pickup truck and go up the road to Julian Baptist Church or down the road to Locust Grove Baptist Church. Then on Sunday afternoon do something like go visit people. And as far back as I can remember, I can truly remember, this is not an exaggeration, I can remember like at 4 years old, looking around at Gray Hargis, Buck Mitchell, and other men like that and thinking, is this what it's going to be like for me? And I can remember the physical reaction to the terror. I can remember my bowels feeling loose and my palms sweating. And I've got a brother that's 12 or 13 years older than I am. And by the time I was 5 or 6, he started taking me across the county line into the wet county, a little place called Gracie where they had the beer joints. And I'd drink big oranges and eat pickled eggs while Dan drank beer. And I would observe and I would listen. And the first thing I noticed was those flashy cars some of those guys had in the parking lots of those old honky-tonks. And then we'd walk on in there, and it's over 40 years ago, and I still haven't found anybody that could sit at a bar as cool as those guys could. One old boy named Lawrence, I remember, would be sitting there, and he'd turn his ring around on his finger and turn that beer bottle around real slow and tap on that beer bottle and gaze down into it for hours. And, man, you could look at Lawrence and tell he was deep. And then one of them would grab a dime or a quarter out of his pocket, slide it across that for Micah, and Aunt Minnie or Daisy, whoever was barmaid back there, would have been scared to death to act like she needed to ask what they wanted to hear. She knew. She'd hot-footed that jukebox, play Hank Williams, Kitty Wells, whatever was hot. And then I'd look over in the booth, and I'd see one of them sitting over there in the booth with his arm around some old gal, looked a whole lot better than them old gals in them flour sack dresses. And those guys didn't care if they were married to somebody else, and no, they didn't care if those women were married to somebody else. And I would sit and listen. And you know, that's really peculiar with old Cherry telling me I had a disease of big deals. Because if you listen just a little while, you found out that every one of those guys was only about that far from being rich and famous. Every one of them had one or more great big deals that was just about to pop, and they were going to be somebody. In fact, if you listen a little longer, you usually found out that some SOBs had been in the way and messed them up, slowed it down, or they'd already popped, by God. And then you'd find out that they were all bad. I'd sit around and drink those big oranges and find out that most of them had nearly had to whip some SOB on the way to the bear joint. And if he'd said another word, would have whipped him. And after a while, I'd get to thinking maybe they'll go back and whip him anyhow. And I sat there at 5 or 6 years old, and I took my first look at self-will run riot, at insanity, at raw ego, at total dishonesty, and I fell in love. At first glance, I wanted to be just exactly like them, and I got my ambition. I just didn't know what the right name for it was. Got drunk the first time when I was either 12 or 13 years old. That first time I got drunk, I got in an awful lot of trouble. I puked, I blacked out, passed out, woke up the next morning, had a terrible hangover, swore I'd never do it again. It was less than a week before I got drunk the second time. Because you see, before any of that bad stuff happened, something else happened. When I got enough of that booze in me that it radiated all the way out from my abdomen to the ends of my fingers and the tips of my toes, my face got all hot and flushed up around, and that went tingled up around my mouth. First time in my life, that hole in my belly quit hurting. For the first time in my life, I was in the right place at the right time with the right stuff. I wasn't too good, I wasn't too bad, I wasn't too smart, and I wasn't too dumb. And most important of all, for the first time in my life, I said to myself down inside, "Hey, Don, how you doing?" And the answer I got back was, "Everything is lovely. There's no reason for you to run. There's no reason for you to do anything. You're okay." And when I look back on that, my powerlessness over alcohol becomes real, real simple. Since nothing else in this universe had ever made me feel good enough inside myself that I could stand the way I felt without running, when I found something that would do it, then it simply did not matter how high the price became. Because in the final analysis, it was the only game in town, and I had to go back to it. Now, I had a drinking career, but I really don't want to get into much of a drunk log today. I probably will. I never want to, and I always do. My drinking career spanned a quarter of a century, from that first drunk until 37 years old. And it was a quarter of a century in which alcohol and alcoholism and the things like alcohol. I was really glad when Francine made her comment this morning, because I too respect Alcoholics Anonymous so much. I go nowhere else for my recovery. I sometimes, without being critical, feel like sometimes folks get out into these things and are standing on a whale's back fishing for minnows, getting into all this psychology and so on, when they're standing on all the power in this universe, right in these 12 steps in our God and Alcoholics Anonymous. But I was glad she said what she did, because, you see, I too am a drug addict. But I don't introduce myself as a drug addict, because if I've got two diseases, I've got 100. Because my dis-ease, my inability to be comfortable inside myself on account of that ego disorder, is so great that if there was any substance, person, place, thing, or activity available prior to April the 9th, 1981, that I thought possibly by using and abusing it, I could make myself feel better inside, let me assure you, if I did not use it and abuse it, it was an oversight on my part. But ethyl alcohol has always been my ultimate drug of choice. And incidentally, ethyl alcohol, despite all the other things that happened to me over the years, wound up being the most destructive drug on any level that I ever put in my body, and wound up being the most addictive drug that I ever put in my body, as well as always my drug of choice. So I'm just real comfortable that I'm an alcoholic. But at any rate, school was easy for me. Part of my cute and smart act, in fact, the biggest part of it was doing well in school and that sort of thing. And I was an early admission student, had been drinking alcoholically for 3 or 4 years by this time. But at 16 years old, I was an early admission student to college up in Louisville, which was the big city to us in West Kentucky. And I went to 1 year day school, found out I couldn't drink the way I needed to without a full-time income, so went to work full-time. Went to school full-time and worked full-time for the next 7 years and drank alcoholically full-time. In fact, for the whole 25 years, I'm real comfortable in telling you that I went to bed drunk, not just drinking, more than 80% of the nights in that quarter of a century. alcohol and alcoholism made every major decision and most minor decisions in my life. I'm not proud of this, but I need to say it. During that whole 25 years, I really didn't have people in my life. I had positions. And whatever your position was, whether it was wife, girlfriend, employer, employee, partner, whatever it was, I usually had one or two other people already interviewed for your position. And there was a good reason for that, because you see, the day was going to come, and it always did come, when you were going to say something along the lines of, hey, wait a minute, Don, something's wrong with the way you're living, the way you're drinking. And the day you said that, now, it might take a year or it might take 2 years of whining, crying, cajoling, bribing for you to actually get kicked out of my life. But the day you said it, you had sealed your fate. You were gone, because I couldn't afford to keep anybody in my life that was going to interfere with me getting the only relief I'd ever known in this universe for the way I felt inside myself. And I had that law career stuck in there that I mentioned earlier that used to be wildly successful and now is sort of moderately successful. And I had my only child. My daughter was born in 1968, the same year I started practicing law in Louisville. By February the 10th of 1978, I had made a good deal of money. I'd spent most of it. A law firm of seven or eight lawyers had built up around this other fellow and myself. I was always a criminal defense lawyer. I'd won a lot of cases. I'd gotten a lot of publicity. We'd built a three-story office building a block from the Hall of Justice downtown. February the 10th was a Friday of 1978, and there was nothing unusual about that day except the fact that I wound up having a wreck. What I did, I was propelled out of bed by the terror. You see, just listening to the facts of my story, you might think that I had some sort of ambition or emotional wellness in me, and I didn't, and I don't want to leave you with that impression. What motivated me was absolute terror that if I didn't keep on doing things and accomplishing, you would see, and I'd have to look at what was inside me. Anything in me that looked like emotional wellness, I'm absolutely convinced, was nothing more than a highly developed lifelong ability to mimic people that I knew felt different and better inside than I did. So that same terror propelled me out of that bed that morning. I went into the office. I did what I needed to do quickly. I went to court. I came back to the office a few minutes. I went to an expensive bar and restaurant for lunch. I spent the afternoon there drinking scotch and snorting cocaine with some other lawyers and a judge or two. I decided I'd been working too hard for the weekend, that I needed to get out of town for a long weekend. I was in Louisville, Kentucky. I made reservations up in French Lick, Indiana, north of there. I started calling ladies that I was seeing. And by the way, by that time, I was remarried to my daughter's mama. Now, I'm not going to try to give y'all a blow-by-blow of my marital history, because I'd like to get done before dark. But let me assure you, I'm not trying to hide anything from you. It's worse than most alcoholics. And I got a hold of a young lady I'd been seeing who was not my daughter's mother, and she said yes, she would get away with me for the weekend. So I went and picked her up and took a handful of Quaaludes. I had a brand-new Corvette with a built-in CB. And after I took the Quaaludes, since I had reservations in French Lick, Indiana, north, I headed southwest to Hopkinsville, Kentucky to see my daddy. I got two bottles of vodka. I thought if they caught you traveling without two bottles of vodka in 1978, they'd write you a ticket. But I got down on the West Kentucky Parkway and got playing with the CB radio, and I got hold of a truck driver that had some of those little old yellow Dioxin speed beans, and he wanted some vodka. So we pulled over, and I gave him a jug of vodka, and he gave me a handful of Dioxin. I made another 50 or 60 miles, went off the road at 130 miles an hour, and that's the first unusual thing that happened in that day in my life in those times. Went off the road at 130 miles an hour, did a lot of bad things to my body, identified with Francine here too. I broke both legs, crushed both knees, lost the main artery in one lower leg. They had to do a bypass in the upper leg and graft in a vein to replace it, separated my pelvis and severed my urethra so that I didn't have a urinary function for over a year. I had a half dozen major surgeries first year after the wreck, spent 6 months of that year in the hospital. The doctors told me that I would probably never walk again without braces on both legs and one or two canes. They also told me that they were doubtful that they'd find a surgeon anywhere that would even attempt to reconstruct my urethra so that I'd have a urinary function. In other words, they were telling me that it was highly likely that I would have that suprapubic catheter, which is nothing more than a plastic tube with a flange on it where they bore a hole in your abdomen and ram that into your bladder to carry your urine out to a bag. And they were telling me it was likely I would have that the rest of my life. Now, I didn't go broke that first year after the wreck because being senior, founding partner in the firm, money kept on rolling in. And my reaction to that in my powerlessness and my sickness was to lay in that hospital bed between surgeries and have my friends bring in booze and more dope than the doctors would give me, and the doctors were giving me a lot of dope. And I would lay in that bed, and I would have a drink in my hand, and I'd say things like this to my friends. I'd say, boys, this, by God, is the only mistress that I've ever been faithful to and the only one that's ever been faithful to me. And just because the price has got a little high, we can't abandon her. And then I'd talk about the fact that anybody that didn't have any backbone could quit drinking when the going got a little rough. That, by God, it took a man to lay in there with it when the bills started coming in. And I'd tell them that a man ought not do the crime if he couldn't do the time. And I'd tell them that when I'd been out there dancing, I knew, by God, the piper had to be paid. And just because he was standing at the door with his hand out didn't mean a thing, except I was going to hobble to the door when I could, pay him what I could, and keep right on dancing best I could. And that, folks, is real insanity. And that's real powerlessness. Because, you see, there still wasn't anything else in this universe that made me feel good enough inside myself that I could stand it. So it didn't matter what the cost had become. About a year after that wreck, when I still had the tube in the belly and the braces and the crutches, this thing the Big Book calls the phenomenon of craving, this physical addiction to ethyl alcohol, got so far advanced and progressed in me that I had to make my first trip to the asylum. And when I use that word, I don't use it to be funny or cute. The Big Book uses that word. Lots of the places I was in were called psychiatric hospital, and lots of them were called treatment centers. But I just lump them as asylums. And by the time I got to that first one, that physical addiction was progressed to the point where it took 3 or 4 days for me to be physically well enough to sit up in a chair and go to an AA meeting. So they got me well enough, and I'm sitting in the chair with my tube in my belly, my bag on my leg, and my braces and my crutches. And somebody read how it works, and they got to step 3, made a decision, turn our will and lives over to the care of God as we understood him. And that so offended my intellect that I climbed up on my crutches and announced as loudly as I could, "Do you mean to tell me there are people in this world who believe such crap?" And I went and made some phone calls to get somebody to come get me away from those religious fanatics before they somehow polluted my pristine intellect. Now, I wound up getting sober about 2.5 years after then, in April 1981. And like Creighton says about his last period there, some of those things are none of your business. But I got to be honest, too. There's very little of it I really remember. Some of the things I do remember are that I went back to the asylum 17 more times in that 2.5 years. I was in the asylum 18 times in 2.5 years. I became addicted to hard narcotics, became a needle street junkie, and I'm so grateful for that. Because that brought enough legal and social pressure on my partners that they kicked me out of the law firm that I'd founded, and I proved I couldn't get straight with a Timex watch. I certainly wasn't going to get straight with a law firm. The state of Kentucky accommodated me a little further by removing my law license. I last laid eyes on my daughter, my only child, in January of 1980. It turned out I wasn't going to see her again for over 3 years in February of 1983. The Internal Revenue took the office building and things of that nature, and I had a habit of leaving wives in houses around along a road called Brownsboro Road outside of Louisville, and the mortgage companies took all those, and the banks put the hooks on the expensive automobiles, and it was just all gone. After the money was gone, I wound up married to the lady that was in the wreck with me, and she had to leave me, and she died during that period of time in an accident while she was staying with girlfriends. I don't know what month or what season of the year I left Louisville. I really have never been able to identify the season of the year. I know that the last year and a half to 2 years before I got sober, I lived on the streets and on an expired Blue Cross Blue Shield card. I probably spent about equal time in asylums and out of asylums. I assumed for that period of time that I would die of alcoholism and drug addiction. And everybody I've talked to who knew me during that period of time has assumed the same thing. When the money was all gone, I went down and stole my father's Social Security money He was in his late 80s and had nothing on this in this earth except his Social Security. Before my partners could get me out of the office with them, I learned to steal from my own partners. Of course, I was telling Creighton and Jim at lunch, when I stole, it never felt like it looked when you stole, so it wasn't really stealing, you know. And when I lied, it never did sound like it sounded when you lied, because I had such good reasons, and it was so frequently not only harmless but for your own good, that I wasn't really lying. But I learned to steal from my partners. I have a much older, badly crippled sister that I badly abused and endangered her health and life to keep on drinking. By the time I hit asylum number 17, it was the fall of 1980, and everything and everybody was gone. I had taken a sick version of the first step of Alcoholics Anonymous, because by that time, for over a year, I hadn't picked up the first one, thinking I might get away with it. I knew I wouldn't get away with it. I knew something real bad would happen, and there was a good chance I'd die. But the pain was so great, and the will to live was so weak, and it was the only game in town, that I just kept right on going with it. Can remember so many nights, just in kind of a flash in the blackout, thinking, my God, maybe this will do it. I've drunk all this, I've taken all this, I've shot all this. And I can remember waking up the next morning with those four horsemen on me, and being driven to that drink so hard, and thinking, oh my God, it didn't do it, I've got to do it again. And it was horrible. I'm so grateful I don't have to be there today, and I hope the memory of that never becomes anything but green in my mind. I'm afraid if I ever forget how I felt when I woke up compelled out of that bed with nothing on this earth, my daughter making no difference, nothing on this earth making any difference, except having to get some ethyl alcohol in my body so that I could feel good enough that I could stand the way I feel. Hope I never forget that. But at any rate, I got in that asylum in Nashville. They only let me in because the director told me later, because he didn't think I would live another week if he left me on the street. Stayed in there about a month. Didn't stay straight. Some people in there had some dope, and I took it. I was never straight 30 days in my life until the 30 days following April the 9th, 1981. I got out and had no place to go. And my roommate was a real young fella, and his family was involved in AA there in Nashville. And they asked me if I wanted to come stay with them a few days. And I went and lived with them on charity for 11 months. And the first 5 or 6 months on up until April of 81, I didn't stay straight or sober, but I got better. I went to a world AA meetings at a clubhouse down there called 202 in Nashville. I got to where I could go 2 or 3 weeks without getting messed up on something, and they didn't put me back in the asylum but one time. And at the rate I'd been going, if I could get those asylum trips down to twice a year, I'd have figured I was well. And in March of 81, I had known ever since my wife had died, which had been over a year, and I had been absolutely destitute. And when I say absolutely destitute, I'm not exaggerating that, for that same period of time. I had known that if I would send a letter with a return address back into Louisville, Kentucky, that an insurance company would send me a check for $2,500. And my fear, my terror of Louisville, Kentucky was so great that for over a year I couldn't get up the courage to send that letter back into Louisville. Finally, in March of 81, I got up the courage, I sent the letter, they spent the money, and I got drunk. And about 10 days or 2 weeks later, I was sitting on the edge of a bed in a motel in Nashville, Tennessee, and a loving God started giving me a whole lot of gifts that I didn't know that I was getting. See, I was deep into what I call that pop-off vodka / Listerine stage of drinking. God, by that time, I'd drunk a barrel of both those things. And if I had waited for coming off a drunk to feel differently than it had felt before, I'd be dead today. I can't tell you that things felt a whole lot differently, but I can tell you that by the grace of God, I did some things differently, and that made the difference. And it's only in looking back for you new folks that I know those beautiful gifts were there, because, you see, I had no idea. In fact, it was an offensive idea to me that there was a loving God that had any impact or power over my brain insofar as running my life. I didn't know there was a loving God, much less that he was giving me any gifts. But I know now that he was. The first one was a will to live that I hadn't had for a long time. He gave it to me, by the way, in humor and curiosity. As I was shaking out that last drunk, I can remember thinking, what would people do with me if I didn't have the common decency to die after all the messes I've made? And that was funny. I got thinking about the fact that, you know, you tell somebody this tearful goodbye that's moving out of the country, and then you run into them at the grocery store 15 minutes later, and it's real uncomfortable. You know what to say to them. And I figured that would be the same way, and that humor was in there. Maybe I ought to just live to see what had happened, you know. And the next gift, I shook out that last drunk. I didn't know why I wasn't going after Listerine and pop off, because God knows I needed them just as bad as I had the last few hundred times I'd come off this stuff. But about the third day, when I was able to get downtown to the 202 Club, I went down there, and thank God the door to Alcoholics Anonymous swings both ways. You see, those folks in that clubhouse knew me real well by that time. I had shot dope in the men's room. I had passed out at meetings. About 2 months before I got sober, a big old boy about 6'6", named Joe W., walked up to me and looked down and said, "Major, I'm beginning to think, by God, you are too intelligent for this program." And I remember swelling up inside and thinking, well, it's about time they figured out who they're dealing with here. And he said, "And you know, that's a real shame, because we have never had anybody too dumb for this program, and we bury you a-holes all time." And that grabbed me like an icy hand inside my chest, and was still stuck in there when I went back in that door. And those lovely people greeted me with the divinely perfect combination of loving open arms and an undercurrent of disgust. And I needed both of them. And I went in and I said, "Hey, will y'all tell me one more time what I need to do if I want to live?" And they said, "Don, we'll be tickled death to it. Keeps us sober. Don't drink, don't take dope, and go to meetings." And by the grace of God, that first 60 days, I went to over 150 meetings, because, you see, I'd gotten another beautiful gift, the first little bit of teachability or humility I'd ever had in my life, the first ability to act in spite of my brain's veto that I'd ever had in my life, because during that 60 days, my brain was still yelling the same old stuff. It was yelling, "Alcoholics Anonymous won't work with you because you're too smart and great. Alcoholics Anonymous won't work for you because you are just too stupid, and there are parts of you that are missing, and everything you have ever done has been fraudulent, and somebody's going to find it out one of these days, and you've made such a mess there's no need for you to try to get sober." Then it turned right around and tell me, "Alcoholics Anonymous won't work for you because you're so intelligent and great. And hey, Don, what about that ocean of compassion and creativity inside you? You know your alcoholism, that's a brother with Ernest Hemingway, Alexander the Great, Winston Churchill. Y'all a brother, Hank Williams, y'all are brothers under the skin." And my brain was yelling at me, "What are you doing down here in Nashville, Tennessee, with your head in the sand and your butt around all these religious fanatics? For God's sakes, boy, get your head out of the sand, get your butt to Louisville, Kentucky, get some money, get a law license, get a good-looking woman, get a Jaguar, get a Rolex. My God, boy, be somebody." But for the first time in my life, I was given that beautiful gift of being able to turn around to my brain and say, "Yeah, partner, I know, but you and I have damn near killed one another. We're going to have to try something else." So I kept on going to those old meetings, even though I knew they couldn't possibly help anybody as special as I was. Then they told me if I wanted to live, I had to read the big book. And I said, "But I've read the big book 3 or 4 times." They said, "Yeah, we know. You've been quoting it around here while you've been dying." Said, "You've got an idea somewhere." Said, "You've got an idea somewhere." And I was a truly astute big book scholar before I got sober. Said, "You've got an idea that this thing is a philosophy book." Said, "Don, you think there's something in there you can learn that'll keep you sober." Said, "If you want to live, you better pick that book back up and act like you've never seen it. This time, don't you look at it as a philosophy book. You look at it as a simple instruction manual for your actions. And if you want to live, you start at the front cover. And you go through it line for line, reading only the back part and not interpreting one darn thing." And said, "If you want to live, you'll be looking not for something to learn, but for something to do. And if you want to live, when you come to a suggestion that something be done, you'll get up and do it." And he said, "Don, on account of your general uniqueness and magnificence, it's just inevitable that you're going to run into suggestions in this book that obviously do not apply in your special case." And they said, "That's all right. Just be sure and do those things first, because you'll need them more than anything." And by the grace of God, I was able to override my brain's veto and start going through that silly book. I didn't like the literary style. It was written on such a childish level. But I was able to start going through it line for line and doing it. And that was about the time that they explained to me, said, "You know, Don, these 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous that are the program of recovery." And I said, "Well, you know, what about going to meeting sponsors and that sort of thing?" They said, No. I said, "The only thing referred to in the first 164 pages of the big book as a program of recovery is steps 1 through 12. They said, "What that means to you, young man, is that you'd be going to 10 meetings a week, sponsoring 35 people, talking at conventions all over this country and working part-time in a treatment center. And if you are not actively working and living your life on steps 1 through 12 of Alcoholics Anonymous, you are not in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'm so glad they told me that. They explained to me that I could latch onto this program like a leech for the fellowship, and that I might stay dry a week or 30 years. But until I worked those steps the way the book said work them, worked the first nine to reach a state of recovery from alcoholism, and then began to live my life a day at a time on 10, 11, and 12 in order to maintain my state of recovery from alcoholism, that I would have absolutely no healing of what's wrong with me inside, that disorder of the ego that makes it so uncomfortable for me inside myself. I'm so glad they told me that. Then they told me if I wanted to live, that I was going to have to get a sponsor. And my brain really vetoed that because I was a great deal smarter than anybody in Alcoholics Anonymous in Nashville. And I didn't want to be brainwashed by any of those religious fanatics. But I asked Cherry Carpenter, who at the time I didn't even like, to be my sponsor. Because, you see, I'd been in a lot of discussion meetings with Cherry. And we'd sit in those discussion meetings, and people would have real problems, you know, losing their children, health problems that could be fatal, going to the penitentiary, getting kicked out of where they had to live, no money to eat on, and people would be talking about these problems. Cherry would listen to us, so I'm sorry you're having a rough time, but, you know, there are no mistakes in God's universe, and any time we make a big deal out of anything other than God and these 12 steps, what we're making a big deal out of is ourselves. And we're back into ego, and we're back into the disease of alcoholism. And we had tried to explain to the old fool, man, you don't understand. This woman was talking about losing her children. Or this guy's got a serious disease. Or you don't understand that this fellow's going to damn penitentiary Monday. Well, I'm sorry, but any time we make a big deal out of anything other than God and these 12 steps, what we're making a big deal out of is ourselves, and we're back into alcoholism. And I say, but Cherry, I hadn't seen my daughter in 2 years, man. I never will get a law license back, and they're going to put me in the penitentiary. And well, I'm sorry, Don, but in time we make a big deal out of anything other than God and these 12 steps. And you know, a good friend of mine, Billy H. in Louisville, he and I talk every day, and it was about 6 months ago we finally figured out we both tend to have an occasional big deal every once in a while, even though we've been in recovery a while. And we figured out that the stress, you know, when you're real important, stress just goes with it. That we figured out, finally, after 12 years sober, stress is impossible in my life unless I have made a big deal out of something other than God and the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I have found that every time I stop, I feel that stress. If I will stop and say, hey, wait a minute, Don, what are you doing wrong? This is a warning sign. What have you made a big deal out of that's not God and not these 12 steps? It's there. And when I start acting like it's not a big deal, see, I ain't got any switches to flip, make things not feel like big deals. But I can ask myself, what would a person do if they didn't feel like this was a big deal? And I can go do it, whether I want to or not. And that works just perfectly. Thank you. And then they told me if I wanted to live, I had to get on my knees and ask a power greater than myself to get through the day without drinking and drugging, get on my knees at night and thank that power. My brain really vetoed that, and I said, my God, I can't do it. You know, this is what's been killing me, this second step. I've tried and I've tried. I've been around you all for 2.5 years now, and I want what you've got. And I've reached inside myself and tried to find these switches to flip to make myself start thinking, feeling, and believing what you tell me I've got to think, feel, and believe if I'm going to get this thing. And I can't find the switches. I've got to die. And I finally heard them when they said, oh, son, we don't know where on earth you got such a silly idea. We have never suggested that you think or feel or believe anything. And I went, huh? Because I've always assumed that my thoughts, feelings, and beliefs were the center of the universe, and if little Donnie was going to do right, why lightning had strike little Donnie inside and make him feel like doing right, you see. They said, oh, no. Said, first place, you're way too sick to have any valid thoughts, feelings, or beliefs. Said, in the second place, your thoughts, feelings, and beliefs are your disease, and your disease is your thoughts, feelings, and beliefs. There's not even any overlap. They're one and the same thing. And it said, in the third place, the issue of whether you live or die, which is very much in question, is going to be determined solely by what you do. What you think, feel, or believe won't have one thing to do with it. So they said, if you want to live, you get down on your knees and you start saying those words, and let us assure you that nothing could be more beside the point than what you're thinking, feeling, or believing while you're doing it. And by the grace of God, I got down on my knees and started acting as if. And the beautiful miracle of the second step happened there in Nashville, Tennessee. I came to believe. And incidentally, I had a total knee replacement 8 weeks ago yesterday as a result of that old wreck back there. And I missed 4 days getting down on my knees in the morning and night. But Sharon, my beautiful, honey, will you stand up? My beautiful wife, for those 4 days, Sharon knelt down by the bed with me and held my hand in the mornings and at night, and I said my prayers. But other than those 4 days and nights, I don't believe I missed a morning or night getting on my knees. A lot of times I haven't felt like it. A lot of times I haven't meant it. A lot of times I haven't thought the prayer was getting past the wall. But by the grace of God, I don't think I missed a morning or a night. And here's how important that is to me today. I don't think, if I won't take those few seconds in the morning and at night to humble myself in front of my loving God who did not give me my life back, I didn't want that thing back. My loving God gave me something so much more beautiful than I ever dreamt life could be. If I won't take those few seconds in the morning, those few seconds at night to humble myself in front of that God, I don't think I can have any spirituality beyond that. I don't think I can get into spiritual graduate school if I won't get on my knees every morning and night. And I also wouldn't think, if I chose not to do that tonight and not to do it in the morning, I really wouldn't think I deserved or really expect a day of sobriety tomorrow. It's just that important to me. So they led me through the steps there in Nashville, Tennessee, and I had to let go of demanding of God that I ever see my daughter again. And I didn't really want a law license back all that bad, and I couldn't find a job. And I spent a year and a half down there and living in an attic with no car and no phone and happier than I ever dreamt it was possible for a human being to be. And as a result of working steps 8 and 9, when I was a year and a half at the Kentucky State AA convention in front of a couple of thousand people at 22 months sober, and my story was on the front page of the Louisville paper the next day with everything except my last name. And the reaction to that among people that knew me was good. It scared me when it happened, but it was good. I saw my daughter that same month. Two months later, April of 83, she moved in with me. Lived with me from then until she went away to college. Got into Al-Anon just till Sharon Gale came along. She's the best friend I ever had in this world. Now she's the second best friend I ever had in the world. People started asking me to sponsor them. They started asking me, you know, saying, gee, Don, you say good things. They started asking me to talk here and there. And my law practice started making money at once. And I started wearing nice clothes again. I started driving new cars again. And all these things were so beautiful. And I want to tell you, those first 9 years of my sobriety were wonderful. And what I'm getting ready to tell you now, I'm not running down those first 9 years. They were absolutely beautiful and gorgeous at the time. But it's just the way I see them now. And for me, I think that's what growth is in Alcoholics Anonymous. I hope that 10 years from now, I can look back and say, man, did I stand up and tell those folks down in Orlando that? That was the silliest damn thing, because I hope I will have grown into another place. But you see, during that first nine years, all those things were going so well. And in the meantime, I want to tell you folks that relationships with the opposite sex and financial chaos were killing me. And every month of sobriety, they seemed to get worse. The more pigeons that I would accumulate, the more conventions I would talk at, the more money I would make, relationships with the opposite sex and financial chaos kept getting worse and worse and worse. Let me tell you what I wanted. All I wanted was a solid, faithful relationship with one woman to go on about my business, let her go on about hers, and be together and be reasonably comfortable. Let me tell you, and all I wanted financially, I didn't want wealth. I just wanted the craziness to stop. Nothing wrong with those goals. Let me tell you tools I was using. Rigorous honesty, 12 steps, prayer, meetings, sponsorship, outside counseling when it seemed appropriate. And every day and every month, it just got worse. I had begun to think that there was something, I had concluded that there was either something missing in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, or much more likely something wrong with me other than what the 12 steps would deal with. Cherry died about 3.5 to 4 years ago, and I talked at a convention up in Indiana, and Tom B. from Cleveland was there, and I really liked what Tom said, and I said, Tom, would you be one of my sponsors? And he said, yeah. So about 3.5 years ago, I flew up to Cleveland. I did it a couple of weeks after I'd met Tom, and you know, those old boys up there at Cleveland and Akron have been sober a long time. There was one old fellow up there that weekend that used to drink with Dr. Bob. And when Tom met me at the airport, he said, Don, whatever it is that you came here looking for, you already have simply because you're seeking. And I thought, oh, my God, I come up here looking for hard answers to hard questions, and Tom's coming with this mystical crap. I realize now that he was exactly right. Then he started talking to me about step six and step seven. And he took me to an AA golf tournament just straight from the airport, and I never played golf in my life. And these old guys, it's like there was a conspiracy. They told, oh, I've been sober 9 years. About time you look at step six and step seven. And I'm thinking, well, my God, I must have listened to 3 dozen fifth steps. 3 dozen times I've told these people, yeah, go on home now. Get the book down. Spend 1 hour looking over the first 5 steps. Make sure you didn't skim. When you're ready, get on your knees. Say the prayer on page 76. Go do the first half of step 8 and call me, and we'll talk about getting willing to make the amends. When I left there that weekend, I realized that I didn't have any grasp at all, not only of Step 6 and Step 7, but of the real truth of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. You see, I'd spent 9 years, and it worked for that 9 years, but I had spent 9 years really using the 12 steps in this fellowship the same way I'd used booze and dope, for the ultimate objective to try to make me comfortable. I thought it was all right to have the objective of trying to make Don comfortable and spiritual. And that said, I got to be comfortable and spiritual before I'm worth a hoot for anybody else. I got to take care of me first. This is a selfish program. And that weekend, the words of Cherry Carpenter, who was dead, rang in my ears. And I never could understand why he'd tell me during that first year. He'd say, son, don't say this is a selfish program. Said, that's not in the big book. What's in the big book is that we must be rid of this selfishness or it kills us. It is impossible without God's help. Said, this is not a selfish program. This is a selfish disease with a solution and a cure that is directed toward other people and God. And by the time I left there that weekend, I realized, and I'd read these things, and I'd shared these things with so many people. But, you know, the third step says, take away the bondage of self so that I can better do God's will, not so that I can get spiritual and I can get comfortable. And it says, take away my difficulties that victory over them may bear witness to those I would help. Not that I can get spiritual and company. When you get to step 7, it says, take away each and every defect of character that stands in the way of my usefulness to God and my fellows. Folks, I don't even know which ones they are. You see, the character defect that's making me the very most uncomfortable at any given time, the one that I've grabbed by the collar and slammed up against the wall and said, okay, God, come down here. I got him. Give me a little help. We'll get rid of him, may be exactly the character defect that you need to see the most in me today to help you on your spiritual journey. And when you get to steps 8 and 9, it says, sure, we are trying to put our life in order, but this is not an end of itself. Our real purpose is to fit ourselves to be of maximum usefulness to God and our fellow man. So they told me, said, son, you need to go back and start doing this program not to make you feel good. That's not important anymore. You go back and start working this program to fit yourself to be of maximum usefulness to God and man. And then it just may be that as a byproduct of that, you'll feel better than you ever felt in your life. But it can't be your objective. It doesn't work that way. And then they gave me another thing to take home. They said, son, of yourself you are nothing. The Father does the work. See, I was trying to get God to give me a little help getting rid of those defects of character. I'm just as powerless over every one of them as I was booze and dope. And I came back to Louisville, and I started doing it a little differently. In fact, I started trying to do it a lot differently. And it wasn't a month before I started dating Sharon. And we got right together, and you know, that was over 3 years ago now that I started dating Sharon, and I haven't had one moment's discomfort with relationships with the opposite sex. And this is from a man that had never had 24 hours free of discomfort with the opposite sex since the first grade. Now, the financial thing's gone a little bit slower. Did you ever try to give something to God with one hand while you were being systematically less than rigorously honest with the other? Very difficult. You see, the Internal Revenue is, in fact, honesty's last frontier. And the silliest idea that my brain had ever heard in its life was that I needed to be as rigorously honest with the Internal Revenue as I need to be with you folks in my dealings with you. I want to tell you, standing up here right today, the silliest idea my brain ever heard is that I need to be as rigorously honest with the Internal Revenue as I do you all. But a little over 2.5 years ago now, the burden of standing up in these rooms and telling you folks how indispensable rigorous honesty is to me even living got to be too much. And I called Tom in Cleveland. He drove down to Columbus, Ohio, and I drove up to Columbus, Ohio. We had lunch, and I went back to Louisville and started vetoing, overriding my brain's veto. And when my brain would tell me everybody does it, and my God Almighty, you won't go to the penitentiary for this, it's just an audit, it's just civil, and you need the money with as much as you already owe the IRS, I started one step at a time saying, yeah, I know, partner, but this is the right way, and this is the way we're going to do it. And some miracles have been happening. Since I last saw Creighton and Jim and the other and Mert and the others and Jekyll Island 2 years ago, an impossible thing has happened. You see, the wreckage of my past was so great that I've carried a six-figure debt from back in the 70s all the way through. Sharon and I have built a beautiful new home, and I couldn't have gotten a mortgage on a little red wagon 2 years ago. I don't know why that's happened. The bills are all paid, and there's money. And I don't know why. All I've done differently is start overriding my brain's veto and started trying to take the rigorous honesty into every area of my life, including that last frontier of the Internal Revenue Service. I want to tell you just a few things before I close here about what's been going on with me real recently. A little less than a year ago, a relative of mine, a very close relative, who I had learned a few years ago had been involved in the sexual molestation of my daughter, was laying on what everybody believed to be a deathbed. And that relative sent me a message that they wanted very much for me to come. And I had a terrible conflict. I was going to feel disloyal to my daughter if I went there. My anger, my hatred at all this was so great, and surely, that was beyond the pale of where I was supposed to forgive. I didn't know what to do. And I talked to some people, and I prayed. And the thought came to me, or the feeling came to me, that at the end of every one of these meetings, we hold one another's hands, and we ask our God to forgive our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. And folks, I cannot afford to have any limits on God's forgiveness of me. I can't afford to have a line that God says, beyond that I will not forgive Don. And it also got real clear to me. You know, when I was about 60 days sober, one of those old fools down in Nashville said there are no degrees of honesty. On any given day, you're either honest or you're not, because if you will lie, if the pressure gets bad enough, you're just quite simply a liar. As long as you retain the right to draw the line and say where you'll lie and where you won't, you have no truth in you. You're a law unto yourself and you're a liar. And it came clear to me that if I retain the right to draw the line beyond which I will not forgive, there is no forgiveness in me. I must let there be no lines. And I went down and I went through the motions of doing the best I could to forgive, and I'm so glad I did. Another thing unrelated. About 7 months ago, the phone rang in my office. Now, when I left Louisville, again, I don't even know when I left. My law license was gone. There wasn't a self-respecting lawyer in Louisville who would have peed on me to put me out if I'd been on fire, and they shouldn't have. And about 7 months ago, this phone rang, I was handed a message, actually, in my office, and was this lawyer a partner in one of those silk stocking law firms, you know, those real highfalutins, and the old tapes were still there. And my first thought was, oh, my Lord, what have they caught me doing? But I called over anyway, and what they wanted was for me to sit on the Attorney Steering Committee of the Citizens for Better Judges, which in Louisville, Kentucky, interviews and screens the judicial candidates in order to determine if someone is qualified to sit on the bench. I can't get from there to here. No way. I can't get from there to here. Just like Francine can't get from there to here. Creighton can't. God did that. And one more thing in my closing, and it just tells me so much how this thing of Alcoholics Anonymous works. I've got a guy sponsor named John G., and John's one of those people that you sponsor and you love too. I've known him for years. When it was time for him to get sober, he called me and he said, "Don, what is it you've got? I want it." And I took him to his first meeting. John and I were just great friends. About 2 years after he got sober, his boat blew up. It burned John pretty badly, and he was in the hospital too, 200 miles from Louisville. And I drove down to Murray, Kentucky to see him, and I sat there and I said, "Now, John, there's something I want to tell you. You know, you're taking all this Demerol, and I've already had 4 or 5 major surgeries since I've been sober. I want to tell you what it's going to be like coming off this Demerol. You see, you won't think it's the dope. You'll think that your world is crumbling. You'll think that everything around you is wrong. You'll think that nothing's right. This AA is a bunch of crap. But you just remember what I'm telling you. It's not the people around you. It's not Alcoholics Anonymous. It's just simply getting that stuff out of your system, and you'll be all right when it's gone." Like I told you, June the 10th, I had a total knee replacement. I was in the hospital 5 days, and I had Demerol shots all that time, and I'd been home about 2 days, and it was time for me to go to my first meeting. God, was it ever time for me to go to my first meeting. And I had called old John to come get me and take me to a meeting. Well, by the time John got there, I had thrown the telephone across the room, not really at my stepdaughter, but I had thrown it across, and when my sponsee was walking into the home of his spiritual guide, spiritual leader, he heard me from the bathroom cursing my own countenance in the mirror about what a no-good SOB I was and that sort of thing. And John just came in nicely and got me in, and we were on the way to the meeting. He said, "Don, let me tell you how it is when you come off that Demerol." Thank all of you, and I love you so much. And thank you for letting me be here. And for you people, come back. It works.